For the topic of today's discussion, I wanted to give you a little report on this meeting I just went to, came back from yesterday. And it's difficult for me to talk about anything else. I'm kind of filled still with the event. It was should I speak a little bit louder? Okay. So if I get too quiet, just let me know, and if it comes to it, we'll put it on the speaker. I went to Monday. I went to Spirit Rock and spent Monday until yesterday morning at Spirit Rock Meditation Center for meetings. And Monday was a meeting of Vipassana teachers, insight meditation teachers, from all over the world, actually, from Europe and from Australia and Asia, and most of them came from America. And there were about 60 people there, 65 people there. And then on Tuesday, until yesterday around 11 o'clock in the morning, there was a meeting for Western teachers Buddhist teachers teaching in the West. And there were over 200 people there. Someone said 220 different teachers of a lot of the different traditions of Buddhism that's found here in the West. And in particular, there was the Vajrayana, the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, and the Zen tradition. So while the Vipassana people were meeting on Monday, the same day, the Vajrayana practitioners and the Zen practitioners, teachers, met among themselves. It was kind of like the pre-meeting meeting. And then on Tuesday, we all gathered together in the big meditation hall at Spirit Rock. And I found myself still kind of filled with this and processing this amazing event that happened. It was probably one of the least meditative events I've been to in years, to have all these meditation teachers together in one place. Spirit Rock is a silent retreat center. It's just all silent usually. And we didn't stop talking for 5 days. It was just nonstop talking. He's talk, you know. And there were these presentations, and you had to listen to the presentations, but otherwise, you know, you'd get up and you turn around, there was someone you wanted to talk to, and you talked, and like a professional conference, I guess. I don't know what happens at those, but so it was very rich and to meet, and a lot of what was valuable for most of the teachers there were the chance of meeting other teachers, and not just teachers in their own tradition, but the teachers in other traditions of Buddhism, and putting faces on names that we've known for a long time. Hearing about what kind of practices other people do, how other people teach, what kind of teachings they have, what kind of emphases they have, learning from each other, being inspired from each other. And it was just like a nonstop Dharma celebration like this. Someone described it as a millennial event. Maybe it'll happen again, but I think that this is the third one we've had like this, and each time it's grown in size. But I think at some point it's going to grow so big that it will feel more and more impersonal. You know, it'll feel maybe more and more like a professional conference rather than a place where the family, the clan, kind of gather together and meet. The first time we met was in 1993. And it was a much smaller group. I don't know, can't say how many, maybe 100. And there were, the main memory most people have of that meeting was the pain that was expressed in the room. A lot of the Western Dharma teachers, in the time that they were students, and their teachers, went through periods of time of a lot of pain, feelings of betrayal from their teachers and whatever. Not everyone, by any means. But it was a common theme. The Zen people, for example, had their scandals with their Zen teachers, Richard Baker in San Francisco, and Mizumi Roshi in L.A., and Sasaki Roshi, and Edo Roshi, and Mount Shasta. Each of these communities had their real difficulties with their Zen teachers, and communities had their difficulties with their teachers. The Vipassana community hasn't had any real scandals in the same way, but there's been a little bit of pain there. Over the years. And then there was a Tibetan Buddhist community, the Vajrayana community. And as some of the Vajrayana teachers themselves described it, Vajrayana whole system is, carries with it to the West some of the feudal aspects of Tibetan culture. And so the teachers are kind of like feudal lords, and kind of the very tight, you know, fiefdoms, you know, the turf, and who has authority, as you know, who has the power. And so it's a big issue about, you know, transferring authority to the next generation. And there was certainly the share of ethical transgressions there also. But the Tibetan Buddhist community hadn't talked to each other as a community. They were all kind of, because they were kind of separate little fiefdoms, they different lineages and different traditions didn't communicate in the same way that the Zen people who met, you know, met together as a group, and Vipassana people. It was the first time the Vajrayana people, many of them had met each other, different lineages, teaching under different, studying under different teachers. And one of the things that came out in the meeting was a tremendous amount of unprocessed feelings of betrayal and pain. And there, remember, there was one point where someone was talking about the pain that they had felt as a student, and was crying, and half the room was in tears. This is, you know, a group of American Buddhist Dharma teachers, you know. And finally, Ralph Steele started singing black spiritual to kind of get the room back on track. And so that was what the memory was from the first meeting. And the second meeting was maybe 2 or 3 years later, was at Mount Madonna, in some of you have been down in Watsonville. And my main memory of that was there was no pain then, but it was more of a kind of wonderful gathering of mature people who met and could meet together and talk about their similarities and differences. And there was a lot of discussion about how some of the senior teachers train teachers, what teacher training is like. And it was very interesting to see the different ways in which people train teachers. Some people have very formal teacher training programs, and you go through this whole program and steps and details. And in some traditions, that idea of a teacher training was went completely against the grain of how they wanted to, how they understood Dharma to be, how they understood practice to be. The very idea of going through a training program implied that there was something to get and some place to go. And they preferred more kind of like on-the-job training. Basically, you just practice together with people. You practice together with your teacher and your community. And slowly, kind of just by the circumstances of being a long-time practitioner, you kind of grow up to be a teacher.
Could you tell us, was that the Vipassana, what you said, or which one was the more, the less formal?
The San Francisco Zen Center had the least formal. and partly because they're a community, and so people living together in community, and taking on the different roles there, you kind of get mellowed and developed, and start taking responsibility, and it just kind of happens. And you're not given any formal training, kind of like on-the-job training. And Jack Kornfield gave probably the most detailed example of a formal. He has a 4-year teacher training program, and he takes about 4 people on each time, and he laid out very clearly how it looks from a distance, you know, the steps and how he does that training. And it was very inspiring to some people to hear that kind of way of doing it. And then there was this meeting, which was the longest meeting of them all. It was the pre-meeting on Monday. It lasted from Monday to Saturday. I think it was a very significant thing for American Dharma. Maybe some of you are not interested in hearing reports about meetings, but the fact that all these different lineages and traditions of Buddhism can meet in one room and rub shoulders and see each other, eat together, talk together, is one of the ways in which we overcome any sense of rivalry or competition or tension or idea of the other. The first day of the meeting, Fred Van Almen, we were talking, the very first panel was a discussion about dialogue between Buddhist traditions, benefits, struggles, strife, and something else, I forget. And there was the opportunity to talk about the differences and how we see each other and struggles and, you know, tensions that might exist between the traditions. But no one was really inclined to talk about such things, partly because Buddhists are polite, And partly because it wasn't the spirit of how we wanted to be together. We were there really to celebrate and enjoy each other. But a Swiss Vipassana teacher then tried to say, look, a number of people try to say, this is not the time to be polite. Let's also be really honest with each other here and say what's going on. And then he made a character. He kind of just made a character description of each of the traditions as, kind of as a way of trying to kind of spark some discussion. But it didn't really go anywhere. No one picked it up. Jack Kornfield described the goals of the conference at the beginning. He was kind of the opening host. It was really his inspiration to have these meetings. Jack Kornfield is very inspired, feels it's very important for the Buddhist community to meet together regularly. And he feels that regular meetings, he quotes the Buddha, regular meetings is how a community stays healthy. And so he's really the inspiration behind these three meetings, is to have these meetings and bring people together. So he talked about that as being one of the goals. But the ultimate goal, he said, was mostly to meet with mutual appreciation and kind eyes, seeing each other kindly. And that's very much what happened for the most part. There was a little bit expression of pain. There was one of the panels was to talk about compassion and engage Buddhism. And then after the panel kind of had done their presentation, how it was organized was that there were panels of three people who would give 10-minute presentations, mostly kind of elicit kind of thoughtful things. And then there would be another panel of three, four, or five people who would give 3-minute responses to those. And then it would be open to the whole room to make responses. And everyone was given the most 3 minutes. If someone ring a bell if they talk longer than that. And then on the compassion panel, then someone did stand up and talked about the pain that she'd felt with her teacher in recent years, actually. And for a few moments there was kind of a reminder of the 1993 meeting. And it didn't go that far in the group process. But then later, I think it was maybe Wednesday evening or Thursday evening, 50 of the teachers met in the evening voluntarily with the particular community that she was part of and spent about an hour and a half processing their pain in their community. And in the end, Jack ended having a healing ritual for them, which apparently was quite helpful. Then, aside from these, there were six of these big meetings. We all gathered together and explore these different topics. There was also these breakout groups, like they have in professional conferences, I guess. And you had to choose which one you can go to. There were six on Tuesday and six on Wednesday. And all kinds of topics, you name it, probably there was a topic covered. And on Tuesday, I went to the breakout group on diversity in sanghas. That was the one that interested me the most. And one of the interesting things that happened at the conference was, in preparation for the conference, a group of maybe six, seven, maybe more, people in the Bay Area who are very interested in the issue of diversity. And some of them who belong to the People of Color sitting group, they put together a booklet of maybe 50-some pages with a lot of stories of how different people of color have experienced their time in different Buddhist communities, mostly in the Bay Area because that's where the people were, and then different articles on racism and race and diversity and such things. And really feeling, I think, some passion, some real interest in trying to get their experience heard by other people. Our community is so much, relatively homogenous, and it was pointed out over and over again at the Diversity Council how awkward it is for people of different ethnicities or different races to come into a group that feels very homogenous. And so we talked. We had a council on that. We talked about that quite a bit, and it was so it felt so important for people there. Then we had a different we set up an evening where I think it was Thursday evening, to continue that discussion, which I went to. So it was Thursday, so I went to that instead of the one on pain in the sanghas. So there was some of that, but mostly the quality of the meeting was more celebratory, and we enjoyed each other and talked to each other. There was so then what happened was, on Thursday the Dalai Lama came, and so some of you maybe here, I don't know if it was in the Mercury News, but it was in the Mercury News also, in the Chronicle, in both, in Mercury News also, and. So the Dalai Lama came and joined us on Thursday, and he stayed until about noon on Friday. So he was there about 24 hours. And some people felt it was slightly awkward, ever so slightly, to have suddenly a Buddhist teacher come who was not going to be, the more equal of the equals. You know, we'd all met so carefully as all equals, and kind of it really felt wonderful to kind of be all together as equals. And suddenly someone was given kind of central position and given a special chair to sit in. And then the panelists, instead of talking to the whole group, the panelists for the councils, what he was for, they would talk to him. Everything was addressed to him then. But he's such a wonderful person, you know, that whatever discomfort people have about the role that he has, the position he has in his particular tradition, he's such a... His personal... presence is such that no one, you know, is inclined not to grant him a lot of respect. So, it also changed the tone of the meeting quite a bit to have him there. It kind of uplifted the whole place and gave it a kind of focus that it kind of lacked the first couple of days. And the Dalai Lama was a real treat in many ways. It certainly was one of the highlights. And I don't know what the impact of him speaking to us will have. But he presented himself, as he does always, as a simple Buddhist monk. I'm just a simple Buddhist monk. You know, what do you want from me? And in the last 20 minutes where he met with the teachers, someone came up to him and said, the moderator said, you know, you have 20 minutes left. You have all these Western Buddhist Dharma teachers all in one place. You know, probably a very rare event. These are people responsible for carrying on the Dharma here in the West. Do you have anything you want to tell them? No. not particularly. He was just, you know, I'm just a simple Buddhist monk. What do you want from me? It was kind of the spirit of how he was. And at some point, the discussion was about devotion and blessings. And he said, people come and expect me to do blessings, you know, want me to do blessings. But I don't have any blessings to give. I'm just a simple Buddhist monk. And then he talked about the Vajrayana tradition, which he's part of. And he talked about how in the tantric path, the Vajrayana path, there's discussion about how it's the fast path. That usually in Mahayana, the path to becoming a Buddha, which is what the goal of Mahayana is, takes many, many eons, many, many innumerable number of lifetimes. You get dizzy if I told you how many lifetimes it took, so I won't get to make you dizzy. Numbers are so big. But the Vajrayana has condensed it all and said you can do it in one lifetime. And the Dalai Lama talked about how there's a claim that you can do it in 3 years. If you follow the Vajrayana path, you can do it in 3 years. And he said, you know, I think it's just propaganda. Like communist propaganda. And then someone in the group said, marketing. And he said, this whole idea that you can do it all in 3 years, it just buys into this Western notion of doing it quickly, kind of getting it over with. What's in it for me? And I can do it quickly, and I'm just going to do it and get it over with, or do it and be the, you know, best Buddhist in the block or something. And he says it's not healthy to have that approach to practice. You need to look at practice as something that's, you know, in his point of view, you know, it takes lifetimes. And you plug away very sincerely and be very, you know, dedicatedly. But you're not so caught up in your the results of your practice and where you're going so quickly. And, you know, you're not looking at your results from 1 month to the next, or one retreat to the next, or this is something that's, you know, that it's a much larger process than anything you can measure by success in small ways. And he's, I've heard, I've known he's this has been a very important theme of his that he's told other times. I was told a story and some meeting here in America, someone standing up and asking some question about progress in the Dharma and how quick can you expect it to happen or something, some issue of, you know, that like that. And the Dalai Lama apparently paused for a long time and started crying in response to this guy's question. And then when he started speaking, it was, you know, people, you guys, is something's really wrong that you are so concerned about speedy progress in your practice. Then one of the panelists asked the Dalai Lama about how Westerners could have more faith in themselves. And this is a common theme for many of the teachers, is that their students or Westerners often have very little faith in themselves. They feel very inadequate or feelings of shame or unworthiness are quite common. So how can we have more faith in ourselves? And I thought his answer was quite profound, or certainly well worth pondering. He said, it all depends on the sincerity of your motivation. You study your motivation for practice and your motivation that you want to live by, and you see if you can find a sincere motivation. And if you can find your sincerity of your motivation, that is what's going to give you your confidence. And I thought that undercut, I think, a lot of the tendency that for those people that feel like somehow there's something innately wrong with them, that there's something wrong with us by who we are. It's not a matter of, you know, no matter what we do, we feel somehow like we're not really living up to some standard, or we're afraid to let people know who we are. But rather, our motivation, the intention, is something accessible to everyone. Everyone can formulate an intention for their lives. And then the Dalai Lama said, yeah, once you formulate an intention and work on it and refine it someone, then you, basically he said you can take refuge in that. You can get strength in that intention. You know the purity of that intention you have. You might have all kinds of other confused ideas and motivations and idea and reactions and emotions and all kinds of things that happen. But the anchor or the ballast for your life can be the purity of your own intention. And then people spoke about how many of us have mixed intentions. But often, if we spend some time reflecting on our intentions, we can maybe find, you know, in that mixed bag, we can find something which is pure or sincere. And then we take refuge in that. And we don't have to beat ourselves up because there's a, you know, it's a mixed bag of things, and we have all kinds of funny motivations also. But rather, remember to be inspired by our own purity of intent that we can have. So he was talking, Dalai Lama was talking to this group of American Dharma teachers who are probably the majority of the people in the West who are responsible for propagating the Dharma and passing it on to the next generation. And so, you know, he was asked about that, and he was completely uninterested in that. You know, he wasn't interested in propagating Buddhism. Propagating Buddhism is not a good idea. If people, you know, want to practice Buddhism, that's fine, and, you know, we'll help them out, but we're not here to propagate anything. What we're here to support in the world is basic human values. And he's, over and over again, other times, and also this meeting, he said, you know, there's wonderful, wonderful things in Christianity and Judaism. There's perfectly good religions here. Why should we come here and propagate Buddhism when there are such good religions here already? And what really what we do is to support people developing these. He feels that there's a very basic human values of honesty and truth and generosity and compassion, which are common in all traditions of religion. And that's really what he wants to emphasize and what he's developing. And Buddhism is one of the traditions that can do that. So he's into propagating these values and not any particular religion. And he, you know, he seemed, you know, basically, he was there at the meeting. He was basically supportive of what we were doing. And then he talked about, one of the issues was the balance between devotion and wisdom. And some people talked about how their avenue, their door into Buddhist practice was through devotion. That they met some teacher and they were really inspired by that teacher, felt a heartfelt connection, And they just, okay, this is the person. I'm just going to follow this person and do what this person says. And you find that kind of approach very much in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, and a little bit in the Zen tradition. And if it does happen, even less in the Vipassana tradition. But so devotion then becomes a door which people then throw themselves into the Dharma, into practice, and then with time, wisdom arises. And for other people, the door is wisdom. As they practice, explore the teachings, learn the teachings, practice, and have the develop wisdom through their practice, then often a sense of devotion will arise as a result of that wisdom practice. Devotion, a sense of devotion or inspiration or faith to the Dharma, to the Buddha, to the Sangha, to the community, to teachers, they often arise. And the Dalai Lama was kind of asked about that, but you know, some people it's devotion first and sometimes wisdom first. And he didn't really pick it up. My impression was that for him, he puts much more store in the wisdom being the first door. He didn't really pick up that devotion should be the first, could be the first one for some people. I think he's a wisdom type person himself. And so, but I think he's also, my impression I got, he's very leery of religion, or at least Buddhism as a religion. And all this, he was really speaking for his own tradition. The sense was that there was all this stuff in his tradition, all these teachings and ways, which I didn't really feel like he was so that enamored with, in the way that many Westerners are enamored in, you know, his tradition. And he talked about, you know, I don't have... there was a lot of discussion about the ordination of women as nuns, which has been a problematic thing in the Buddhist tradition. The ordination lineage has been lost, both in Theravada Buddhism and in Tibetan Buddhism. And should it be reinstated, or how should it be reinstated, is a big issue. And the idea, some people feel, well, some person of great authority should just say, by decree, you know, we're going to start the order of nuns again. And the Dalai Lama, as people see, is kind of like the Pope of the Buddhist world. You know, if he just said, we're going to do it, then it's done, right? And he said, you know, I don't have any authority. I don't have any authority to do that. So he dismissed his role as being someone who's full of blessings, full of all these magical abilities to kind of bless people and heal people. He dismissed any sense that he had some great authority. I'm just a simple Buddhist monk. It was so refreshing in this group of teachers to have someone like him. You know, he was the person we were all kind of like got down and bowed to, right? He didn't really want it. but you know, anyway, so he had the wisdom approach, and he felt it was very, very important that people have a very solid foundation in the teachings of the Buddha before they get involved in some of the higher, he didn't use the word higher, but like the Vajrayana traditions and Guru Yoga and things like that exist in the Tibetan tradition. And the one teaching of the Buddha that he kept coming back to, which he saw as the framework for all of Buddhism, is the Four Noble Truths, which many people will often overlook because it's so simplistic in the formulation of it. But he said this is really, you know, the heart of it, the foundation, the framework for all of the Buddha Dharma, for all the Buddhist practices and teachings, is the Four Noble Truths. And it's really important you get that as a foundation of your practice first and foremost. And for me, I would add to that not only get it as the foundation, but continually to revisit it over and over again, and to see how tremendously profound the Four Noble Truths are. As more profound teachings are understood, to go back then and see them from the perspective of the Four Noble Truths, and you'll see that they are actually contained in the Four Noble Truths themselves. And if you only understood it by studying something else for a while, but you could have understood it if you had spent more time with the Four Noble Truths. So that also was, you know, very refreshing, at least for me, was to have this emphasis on the Four Noble Truths and the basic teachings of the Buddhism as the foundation. That we're not propagating Buddhism or propagating these values. And this is very common in the West now. Maybe many of you know this. There's a very strong current in Western spirituality or Western religion, in all the different traditions, Christianity and Judaism and Buddhism, and probably in Islam also, of playing down these traditions as religions and emphasizing them more as spiritual traditions. And what this means for most people in particular is when you focus on spirituality rather than religion, you're focusing on developing particular human qualities as opposed to accepting or buying into particular tenets of religion or beliefs. So qualities of compassion, of love, of kindness, of freedom, qualities of generosity, honesty, virtue. These are particular qualities that can be developed. And the impression I get is in the last years there's been a strong emphasis on developing these qualities in some certain strands here in the West. And this is what people call spirituality. And you find that in the Vipassana tradition too. One of my dear Vipassana friends, teacher friends, is allergic to using the word religion when talking about Buddhism, but refers to it as a spiritual tradition. So it's quite something. So President Clinton, as kind of a part of the political gamemanship that goes on, or kind of chess playing that goes on, has assigned the Secret Service to guard the Dalai Lama in the last couple of years. He might need it. Maybe it's a good reason for it, but it's also part of the way of Clinton saying, look, I'm treating the Dalai Lama as a head of state when he comes to our country, so that it's a message to the Chinese. And so, but anyway, so Spirit Rock was, you know, swarming with
80.
What?
80?
Yeah. And the head of the Secret Service, who was kind of running the whole show, was this sweet little grandmother with curly hair and small, plump little woman. You know, it just seemed like she could have been anyone's sweet little nice grandmother. And she was a bomb diffusion expert. You know, and she was going and running around kind of supervising all these guys with their and gals with their guns and headsets and standing next to the altar. The Dalai Lama was kind of sitting in front of the altar and standing next to the altar behind him. Every 20 minutes they'd rotate, a new person would come in and, you know, it's headset over their ears and beady eyes looking at you, kind of. Everyone I talked to said they felt that they were being stared at themselves personally, and they were about to be carried off. Like these people were convinced that you were the terrorist, and you know. And I certainly had that feeling sitting there. These people, these people look at me straight at me, like it's you, isn't it? There would be the Buddha, and there would be the Secret Service agent, and some of them, you know, maybe you could sign them by getting older and older. It seems like, especially women get younger and younger. But there were these girls up there, young girls up there, you know, with guns and beady eyes. So it was not equal opportunities to employ the Secret Service. Yes?
Do you have any feeling what the effect on them was of all this Buddhist
Well, I've been told that they're not supposed to listen to anything being said, but there was a couple of them I could see who kind of would couldn't help but look at the Dalai Lama who was speaking sometimes and broke out laughing at some of the jokes. But, you know, mostly they just stood there, you know. But one of the teachers wandered off into the hills and bumped into the periphery. It kind of created this huge periphery around Spirit Rock with a string, and they had these guys and gals kind of walking around. You kind of look out the Spirit Rock window. And you see these guys walking up on the hillside, you know, scanning for whatever. And so someone walked in, the teachers walked up there and bumped into one of the Secret Service agents and asked, how is this for you, to be guarding the Dalai Lama? And they said, oh, it's okay. He said, oh, really? I'd like to know. How is it for you? They said, oh, it's actually pretty easy. Dalai Lama's always happy.
I just want to say, a very good friend of mine's father was a he was an investigator for the IRS. Secret Service comes under that, and sometimes he was assigned to be a Secret Service agent. So not all the people, I'm sure, guarding the Dalai Lama were full-time Secret Service agents.
I see. They're just local IRS agents.
Yeah, and they need extra as they bring them in.
Yeah, well, they had very stars. There was the agents who had these flax jackets or whatever, these kind of vests on, and kind of lay clothes. And then there were the ones that were dressed. They were kind of at the gates where you came in, and metal detectors and all that. And they had these completely white, starched, bleached shirts. I mean, they looked like, you know, the honor guard almost. Maybe they were the IRS people. And so then a couple of kind of fun things. So on this Friday, at from 11 to 12, there was going to be a little sub-meeting for the Spirit Rock staff and teachers and kind of board members and who had kind of put it all on. And so it was a meeting of maybe 100, 200 people met in the walking meditation hall at Spirit Rock with a Dalai Lama. So spouses were invited, so and family was invited. So my wife and son came up to be there. And so we were all there in the room together with up front in the front for the Dalai Lama. But my son, who's 2.5, my wife had told him, you know, we're going up now to see the Dalai Lama. And he said, oh, the big alpaca? And I told that some people, they didn't know what an alpaca is. An alpaca is a kind of a llama from the Andes. Yeah, from the Andes. So, the big alpaca. And so, but after about 5 minutes, you know, the Dalai Lama didn't really kind of register for my son. He hadn't seen me in 5 days, so it was like a big deal to see me. And so he sat in my lap for a while, but you know, it started to escalate. So I took him out and outside in the courtyard and played with him for a while. And then when the Dalai Lama was about to leave upstairs, they started doing some chanting. They chanted the refuges in Pali. So I told my son, oh, let's go back in now. I said, they're singing in there. Let's go in and join the singing. So he started singing Old MacDonald Had a Farm. And then when the chanting of the refuges stopped, all the people, all the teachers who were close to my son heard E-I-E-I-O. So that was kind of, it was nice.
Did you attend the Zen Buddhist as well?
There was a Monday at the same time, so I couldn't be in two places at once. I don't have that ability. So that's my thoughts. I hope it was interesting enough. I'm still processing and responding to it and dealing with it. But the fact to have all these people together in one place, you know, is phenomenally significant. And one of the things I was struck by was some of these people I've seen at three different meetings now over the last 7 years. It was very interesting to see how they changed. And I don't know how much it's because I've changed that I see them differently, but I see changes. And some of them I could see this greater radiance in their eyes and their face than they had 7 years ago. If practice really works. And some of them who seemed very together and present and stable and still and kind of intimidating, so some of the Zen teachers in particular, 7 years ago, I didn't really want to talk to them. Just they seemed like, you know, too what?
Starchy.
But in starchy, they seemed too still or something, just like they had relaxed. I didn't realize that they needed to relax, but, you know, they were just kind of like, you know, here they were, you know, just kind of. So, practice works in all ways.
Speaking of relaxed, in what context was the mouse impression?
Yeah, I had to leave for that. Because my son, so I wasn't part of that. I didn't ask my wife. Couple of minutes. Anyone want to ask any questions?
Yeah, I was interested in earlier when you were talking about the teaching techniques and so on. Where did Jack get his stuff? Did he get it from Asia, or did he?
Oh, try to train teachers.
Training, yeah.
Oh, he just made it up.
Oh, he did.
You know, he saw. I mean, mostly, he isn't that. When he gave a talk at that meeting, it was very formal. It seemed very formal, and people were inspired by it. But having gone through it myself, it doesn't feel that way. You know, it just it's 4 years of meeting periodically and talking about issues that seem important to talk about. It kind of arises out of kind of obvious what you talk about when you get together, when you're training people. Yeah.
To be a little bit contrarian.
Please.
There are two thoughts that I had. One was about the Dalai Lama, who me personally, is just an extraordinary human being. But in the next week, it'll be interesting to see how this simple Buddhist monk is perceived by Americans. Tomorrow night he's on Larry King, and then he's in Los Angeles for teaching sessions at the large sports arena, and some very expensive blessings that he's giving that are costs more expensive than scalp seats to see Bob Dylan, to see the Dalai Lama in those settings at Forest Lawn.
$500 a ticket, is that right?
$300 a ticket. And you need to arrive about an hour and a half early for the Secret Service to go through all of your stuff. So in some ways I have this sense that he would very much like to be a simple Buddhist monk.
Oh, yeah.
Because all of this other stuff is swirling around and it must be exceedingly difficult to control.
Well, he is head of state and he's very aware of that in that role. There's a professor at Stanford in the history department whose specialty is has been specialized in recent years on Buddhist political theory. And he knows the Dalai Lama and has met with him various times, and they like having talks about political theory. And the Dalai Lama told him, you know, all these people, they want to come and talk to me about great Buddhist philosophy, and or they want to talk to me about, you know, the Chinese. But really, you know, I love talking about political theory. I'm a head of state. That's what I want to talk about. And so few people want to talk to me about that. So definitely he's very conscious of his role, of his position. And I don't know see how that's contrary, but it just, I mean, he holds different roles, different hats.
I tried to look at it from the point of view of the largest number of people that will be perceiving him over this period of time, and that some of those things are difficult to be consistent with.
I agree with that. I'm a little bit uncomfortable, but with myself being Norwegian, maybe where that it had long legacy of equality, longer than America. It's fine for me that one particular Buddhist tradition should hold someone up as being so exalted, but then for all the different Buddhist traditions to kind of band together and kind of see him as kind of like a Buddhist pope, it makes me feel uncomfortable. I mean, in a sense, I would feel that when you come to other traditions, you should kind of meet the others as kind of equals, and regardless how high you are in your particular tradition. But as I said earlier, because he's such an amazing person,
right,
you know, I'm willing to offer him whatever. But at the same time, it is setting up a system where that's kind of expected. So a future Dalai Lama might be not have the same personal qualities as him, and then it's kind of been entrenched then, you know, how we treat him.
Second quick thing is you suggested that Western religions are moving closer to an identity as spiritual rather than religious.
No, I would say, if I could interrupt, it wasn't that I was saying that. I was saying you find a current in the West of people within the different traditions who are focusing more on spirituality rather than on religion. I mean, you find a lot of religion. I mean, there's no shortage of that.
Right.
But this seems to be something relatively new in the last, right, 20 years or so, the increasing focus on spiritual qualities as opposed to other aspects of religion.
I would suggest that the most rapidly growing and influential body is evangelical Christians, who are exactly opposite direction. So that's kind of like the tidal wave.
Right. It is a tidal wave all over the world, in South America and Russia and the United States. And I was a little bit frightened by, or uncomfortable by the Southern Baptist decision recently concerning women and gays and partly because of where they came from, the Southern Baptists. They were the most liberal and egalitarian, right, individualistic of the traditions. And,
right,
and then somehow, slowly, over the years, they've become the opposite of what they were 100 years ago. Yes, Helen.
In the word, the distinction between spirituality and religion, I was having a conversation with somebody the other day. They didn't think Buddhism was a religion, and I asked why not, and they said, well, there aren't any religious extremists to the Buddhists.
Oh, there are.
So that's my question. Is there that element, and where?
Oh, all over, everywhere. Every tradition has them. You know, it's maybe a little bit hard to see here in the West, but if you go to Asia, there's a lot of Buddhist fundamentalists there. It doesn't take long to find them. And sometimes in the Westerners, when they look at Asian teachers who come to the West, we have this naive way of kind of giving them the benefit of the doubt often, where they're actually giving the same kind of, you know, there's a framework of fundamentalism that some people put Christianity in, some people put Muslim in, some people put Judaism in, some people put Buddhism in. But sometimes when we look towards the East and look at Buddhism, it's just this great religion, we don't notice the framework of fundamentalism. It just seems like this is a wonderful thing, right? And we're willing to give the teachers benefit of the doubt and believe them, this must be the truth. But there's plenty of fundamentalism, you know, as much as you'd want.
That's what I get.
So, you know, there are people in the West sometimes have a very naive approach to Buddhism because they see it as a unitary thing. They see there's just one and individuals. And, you know, some of the expressions at the conference even were bordered on being fundamentalist. There was, oddly enough, one of the people who had a reputation as being the most liberal radical, you know, in some ways is, as one of the teachers, and is a fundamentalist in being radical. You know, it was actually frightening to me. The person stood up and spoke at the meeting and about some various things, and it created kind of a tear in the meeting for a while because of this radical approach, this fundamentalist approach, very us and them kind of approach, dismissive of other people, and it felt very much out of the spirit of how we were meeting there. So be careful. Yes?
Is this almost a stage in religious development? I mean, it's almost like what Buddha went through when he became an ascetic, and he said he looked at everybody with angry eyes, and he thought it was so much. Then the fundamentalism is almost like that. It's like, this, I've developed this, and this is the way, and you're not that.
Maybe. I mean, the Southern Baptist seems to be, you know, if you follow them historically, you know, how is the stage is developing there? Maybe it's not fair to talk about them, but it goes up and down. The point I was trying to make is that we don't want to be too quick and say there's always a linear stage as it goes, you know, it goes up and down, round and about. But there is some degree. I was talking to one of the teachers there who comes from a very particular tradition that's kind of recreated itself in the West, kind of almost like a new Buddhist tradition, and very successful. In where it is, and one of the main teachers of that tradition was there, and very friendly man. I had lunch with him, and I said, you know, he seemed very open and accepting. And I said, you know, I wanted to make a comment about how I've experienced your tradition in the past, and that is that it seems like your members have come to these meetings in the past, and my contact with you guys in the past has been, it's very much us versus you guys. You know, we have the right way and kind of a self-righteousness about us and our way, and everyone else is, you know, them. Everyone else is put in one category, which is one of the ways in which fundamentalists work, you know, it's them. As opposed to seeing the great diversity. We have something unique. Everyone's unique. You know, but you have this idea, we're the ones who are unique, everyone else is them, and kind of lumped together. So I said that to him. I said, that's how I've experienced you guys in the past. I'm not experiencing that from you now. You're here in this meeting, and it seems very open and accepting. And he said, oh yeah, that's a very fair criticism. He said, that's a very fair comment, what you had. It's true, we were that way. And he said, I think it was a result of our lack of confidence, our insecurity that we had. when we were starting. And now we have much more self-confidence, and now we don't have that so much. So it was very nice to have that expression of recognition and honesty. So that's kind of the flavor of how it's, you know, very much how it's developing. And the, in our particular tradition, the Theravada tradition, there was for years a real wall between, a critical wall between the lay Vipassana teachers and the monastics in the West. And in the 80s, you know, it was like they would kind of say, I mean, we're not going to have anything to do with them. You know, whether the lay people would say, well, those are the monastics, they're uptight and into the forms, and they don't really know about meditation, they're just into the rules and everything or whatever. And then the monastics would talk about us and say, you know, those lay teachers, they're not living the pure way, and they're commercializing the Dharma, and they're making a living from it, and, you know, and you shouldn't do that, and all kinds of, you know, they'd be, you know, and then it was, you know, talked back and forth, and there was always like this criticism, if anything. But and then as both communities have matured and grown, they've been able to relax. And in the last couple of years, they've started to meet each other. And the most dramatic was last July in England, we had a Vipassana Theravadin meeting. And the first time the monastics came, and we were like family. And they treated us as equals. They didn't have any kind of self-righteous one-upmanship that they often, elitism, which the monastics sometimes have had. And the lay teachers were completely ready to kind of, you know, listen and be friends. And that continued in this meeting. More monastics came, and the meeting of the monastics and lay. And so there's a sense of other, you know, and being critical of the other. And our tradition is dropping very, very quickly. And one of the very satisfying things in the meeting was that, for me, was that, in my perception, and maybe it's not accurate, there are some Vipassana teachers in the West who are outside of the Vipassana mainstream, if we're allowed to say that. The mainstream is IMS and the Spirit Rock. And then, which is a kind of network of teachers who are colleagues and work together and teach together and learn together. And then there are some people who've gone off to Asia and studied on their own with great teachers over there and come back as individuals and set themselves up as individual teachers outside of this network we have. And some of them being, I've heard stories about how some of these individual lone ranger kind of teachers around are very critical of the Spirit Rock and IMS scene. And it's very easy. It's very, you know, we're kind of this big sitting duck just waiting to be criticized, you know, just we're so public, you know. And so it's very easy to say that the other than them. And it was really satisfying to have some of these people come to the meeting and see them kind of meet. We all met each other and talked. And it's once you start talking and meeting people and seeing them face to face and hearing how they teach and their suffering and their difficulties and their inspirations, it's very hard to see them as an other. You start seeing them as the same as yourself. And one of these people who I had this phenomenally heartfelt connection, you know, we went for these long walks together and kind of, you know, we would just kind of be stunned in silence, kind of looking at each other in our eyes and just all this wonderful recognition and of depth of, you know, life was, you know, he was in tears a little bit at one point and just, you know, as we shared our lives and our practices and our experiences together. You know, it's going to be very hard for us in the future to kind of see each other as the other, as, you know, that person who's that off there doing that thing, and how could he be doing that? And, you know, and we're all in it together. So it's very, very valuable to meet together this way. I think it really helps make a healthy environment, healthy scene. And maybe next time as we become even bigger body of teachers, we have to meet more than 5 days. Maybe it has to be 2 weeks. And I'll show up here. I won't be able to sit up anymore. I'll just be so exhausted from all that. So, I hope that was something you appreciated hearing, and I hope that you enjoy the speakers who are coming here this summer. I'm very pleased to leave you with them. I hope that as they do come here, that you remember to be generous with them with the Dana. Maybe this is inappropriate to say. But when the guests come, and there's, you know, this is a relatively small group today, maybe to be a little bit extra generous so that some of them are coming long distances, some of them short distances, but some long distances, and it's nice to kind of so that they leave feeling somehow respected for what they've done. So thank you all, my friends.